Backseat Producers, episode 136, The Princess and the Frog.
Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Dan.
And this is David.
And we are the Backseat Producers. But that David doesn't sound like the normal David.
This is the substitute David.
What movie is this? I didn't watch it. Who is that? My butt. There.
That's okay. A pretty good approximation.
You are the David. All right, so this week we are going to talk about The Princess and the Frog. We were supposed to talk about Hero tomorrow, but the normal David could not make it. He had a work obligation, so we're just postponing the schedule a week. We switched things around and...
reconfigured.
Yeah, and because this movie I have watched probably about 6 or 7 times since Easter.
And you're still living?
About a week and a half ago. We've had it in heavy rotation.
On the
Blu-ray player.
Ooh. Man, big load of Disney in one short week.
Well, that's the advantage and disadvantage of having children, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there are times when it can be painful. Holden's Spider-Man 3 phase was rough at the beginning. I actually, toward the end, I have a really good analysis of that film that I could lay out. And that movie is very obviously a movie that was influenced and made worse by the studio.
Oh, yeah.
An entire room
of suits designed that movie.
It's very obvious what they did, where they were going with the beginning of the movie. And at what point the suit stepped in, because pretty much everything from Venom on is when the suits got involved, because all the stuff with Sandman is so good. It really is very well done. And then Venom comes in.
and they ended up wasting the Sandman and wasting Venom.
It ruined what they really had going, really well with Sandman. It brought it down. It was hard to recover from.
Spider-Man 3 is actually Spider-Man 4 and 5 combined.
3 and 4, yeah.
And 5 and 6.
Yeah, I think it was like everything they had, they threw at the wall and hoped it would stick.
Hey, Spider-Man likes kids. Why don't we add some babies?
And a dance number. And some singing.
What's that, David?
Aren't you glad we've moved on to Disney now and we have intentional musical comedies?
Yeah.
Well, truthfully, as a segue, I was afraid that Princess and the Frog was going to be designed by the suits because of them returning to hand-drawn animation after such a long break. But it doesn't feel like they did, other than that they didn't stray very far from their formula.
No. And I don't think they strayed real far at all from the formula. But for me, and we'll go ahead and jump into this now. The high-level reviews, for me, this was one of the best hand-drawn animation movies I've seen in a long time. And we've been re-watching a lot of them with having the kids. We've been re-watching the Lion King movies and Beauty and the Beast and, you know, the whole gamut. And I really liked this one. I thought this one hit really well. And not just the hand-drawn animation, but it was good even in the realms of the digital animation. It almost felt like this movie pulled some influences from Pixar in the creative process of the story, at least.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can tell that John Lasseter is now running the show.
Yeah.
In every sense of the word. Well, one, he came back and said, we're going to do hand-drawn animation again.
Mm-hmm.
Because the suits at Disney said, oh, kids, they just want it, you know, in 3D computer-generated. Kids don't care how you create it. They just care if it's a good story or not.
Mm-hmm.
He understood that. The other guys didn't. And that's what was killing Disney.
Well, Disney's kind of been killing itself ever since, like, Walt died. I mean, for a long time there, they lost the vision thing, as they might want to put it. I mean, it was a movie first and everything else second.
Well, they kind of bounced back, though.
Well, they
handed the animation back to Roy, when Roy was still, you know, healthy and running the show, that, you know, then you got The Lion King and The Little Mermaid, and they bounced back.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Roy started to kind of, and the, there was no well, Disney
they,
again.
Well, when it started designing by a marketing committee, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
but even then, I mean, there was some good movies that came out of the marketing stuff. Lion King 1.5, for my money, is the most fun of all the sequelized stuff that Disney has done. As far as I can think of.
I have trouble watching those sequels, though.
The sequels, watching most of the sequels are rough. Lion King 1.5, I had a lot of fun with. It's Timon and Pumbaa's story.
Yeah, and it's if Lion King is Hamlet, Lion King 1.5 is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Right.
Going back to the story, I mean, it's Hamlet, you know. They were putting out very, very good stories at first. Just this week, they were showing a documentary down here called Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is all about the rise and fall of Disney animation in the 90s. And what happened is that, you know, they had been kind of getting away from animation in the 70s. You know, they were putting out stuff like Herbie the Love Bug and Chitty Bang Bang and stuff like that, where Disney was turning into kind of a crappy live-action producer.
Well, they were kind of trying to become a B studio.
Right. But then I want to say it was Eisner, when he got in, he said, you know, why don't we make an animated movie? And so they got together and they put out Cinderella. Cinderella? No.
No.
It was...
They were...
Beauty and the Beast.
No,
that was later.
Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid was the first of the...
Well, Great Mouse Detective was actually prior to that.
Yeah, that's true.
That was the beginning of Eisner's.
Stuff like that.
Right, and
you know, that was their first really big success, and then suddenly they were like, well, these make money.
Ooh.
And so they started just throwing money at the animation departments, and they were getting it back, you know. The animators were getting their own agents. They were driving around in convertibles. It was crazy. But then they stopped making good stories. They were just like, well, if it's animated, kids will eat it up.
Yeah, we can put any piece of crap out there.
Doing you know, stuff specifically designed to target audiences. And you had movies like Treasure Planet and Home on the Range and. Just awful dreck, and nobody went to go see it. And when they saw that, they were like, well, it's obvious that these 3D movies, that's what kids want to see. And so they shut down the 2D animation. Far from it, though. Like we've been saying, it's all about the story. And that's what John Lasseter is good at. That's what he recognized. That's why Pixar's 3D animations do so well. Why Toy Story was
such a work of genius.
2D animations, but it's because people want to see good tales.
Yeah, because really the CGI in the first Toy Story is not all that great.
No.
When you watch it, especially now, you see the flaws in it pretty quick. But the story makes you forget them.
Yeah, the story is so solid in that you look past all that very quickly.
I'm surprised though they haven't gone George Lucas on it and gone back and done Toy Story the Special Edition, where they fix all the stuff they wanted to. But other than making it 3D, which is something they've wanted to do since the beginning, they haven't changed it. I mean, when they re-released it, it's the same Toy Story.
That's because Pixar doesn't have all the money of God.
Well, they're doing pretty well at the moment.
Yeah, I know. They do.
And they do, but they'd rather spend their money on newer stuff rather than going back and keep redoing the old stuff.
Well, truthfully, the thing that made me sad was that they've gone to some easy sequels, though, too. You know, the fact that Toy Story 2 and 3.
Cars 2.
And Cars 2 is coming and, you know, that kind of stuff. To me, I wish they had gone to really new stuff, you know, come up with some more new ideas than let's just go and mine what we have.
That and aren't they doing a licensed property like John Carter?
They're doing Carter Mars, but that's Disney, not Pixar.
Pixar is
okay, because at one point I thought that was actually a Pixar project.
John
Carter Mars has been a project of everybody's at one time or the other. Yeah. It's kind of like about several years ago in Enid Cool News, there was some test footage that was actually found where Disney had actually worked on test footage of what it was going to look like. And it looked pretty interesting, but unfortunately it never got off the ground. It may get off this time, but it's like Watchmen. How many years did that get talked about before somebody finally got it on the screen?
Well, John Carter's filming, so they'll have it done.
And honestly, it wouldn't be bad if they started bringing in some other properties. There's a reason why the movies that Brad Bird have worked on are some of the best movies that Pixar have put out, and that's because he's coming from a different place than the people inside of the studio. His movies aren't necessarily about reconciliation and coming back, there's a common theme between Finding Nemo and Cars, but it doesn't extend to Incredibles and Ratatouille.
Right.
Well, and you can certainly see the influence of Brad Bird at that point, because Brad Bird, I think, revitalized Pixar, and that, you know, is where you get Incredibles and Ratatouille from, as opposed to the John Lasseter influence, which is Cars and Toy Story. And now they need somebody. Well, they've got Pete Docter, that's the Monsters Incorporated, and Up, which to me, Up is their masterpiece. I don't think they've done anything. For one, I could just see the pitch meeting where they said, we want to make a movie about an old man that hates kids, and it'll be a kids movie, you know. And
we've just released the episodes recently because we kind of
talked about
been getting caught up. But we did an episode on Up, and right about the same time we did an episode on Gran Torino. And what's interesting is the characters of Walt and Carl. They're the same character. One had kids, the other didn't.
Right.
One had kids to be disappointed in. The other one didn't have kids, so he wasn't disappointed in. He just didn't really care for them.
Yeah, just give Clint Eastwood some balloons and you've got Up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it is interesting how that stuff kind of goes, you know, cyclical. Now Brad Bird's left Pixar. He wants to make live action. And in fact, he's about to make Mission Impossible 4.
I'm in for that.
I'd be in for that. Just to see what sort of trainer it could be.
With Brad Bird behind it, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
What I wish they would have given him was the Fantastic Four, because he made the best Fantastic Four movie ever made.
Yeah,
it was called The Incredibles.
Mm-hmm. Second only to Incredibles was Corman's Fantastic Four movie. It was not well made, but
at least they read the comic.
The people that made it had a lot of heart in making it. They tried.
Yeah,
with what they had available to them, and with a studio that only wanted to hold on to their license, and they made the movie for no other reason than to hold on to the licensing rights to it. It's actually a watchable film.
Well, unfortunately, you're probably going to see a lot of those right now.
Yeah.
Because all of the licenses that Marvel has out, since Disney just bought them, will expire if they don't make a movie. So you're going to see, like, a piece of crap Daredevil movie, another, you know, Fantastic Four movie, X-Men, just anything they can crank out to hold on to those licenses.
Yep. All right, let's get back to what we're supposed to be talking about.
What was that movie we were talking about tonight?
So
I think it's something about a frog.
So I've already thrown in. I love this movie. I really enjoy this movie. Daryl, what did you think?
I thought it was pretty decent. I mean, it's Disney. You can watch it. You can't hate it. I mean, the animation is really good. You just, even for that, technically this is a very nicely done film. The characters are kind of lovable, and like I say, I can't hate it or anything. I mean, but it's Disney.
Well, let me preface this by saying that I've loved Disney my whole life. I went to animation school, and my wife and I go to Disney World about once a year, and we have no children. So my love of Disney has no bounds. And with that, I was dying to see a hand-drawn movie come back. And I think they did a good offering of it. I wish they'd taken it further. But I do like the movie. I enjoyed it a great deal. I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but it was very enjoyable. And I just wish they'd, you know, take it as far as Pixar is taking what they're doing.
Well, yeah, that's the one thing about a bunch I call the Disney Princess movies. They're really formulistic. I mean, you can pretty much lift the characters and most of the story out of one for the other and just interchange the location.
Yeah, heaven help you if you're a parent in that, because you're going to die in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, you can, but I think this one played on a lot of those tropes and played on them in interesting ways.
Well, it was nice to get Randy Newman loose in that type music.
Yeah.
You know, that's his era. That's his music. And to turn him loose and let him really do his thing, that gave a lot of the heart to this movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wrapping a story around it probably was a piece of cake.
Mm-hmm. David, what's your thoughts?
Well, we've said that it's a return to formula, but, I mean, Star Wars is just the hero's journey. So I think that, you know, returning to a good formula, that's wonderful. And I think that at the film itself, yeah, it's good. Some of the music, you know, I don't like Zydeco, you know, but no, it's
well,
it's
you were in trouble going,
you know?
In.
Yeah,
it's a thing. It's, you guys have already said it. It's a good movie. It's a return to form, and it's a return to form that I've been waiting for a long time. It's good for animation as an industry, and as an art form too. It's because this movie did make a turn of profit. It wasn't, and there are kids, you know, dressing up in Tiana outfits for Halloween long before the movie even came out. So,
well, part of the reason that the movie turned a profit though is also to do with how the animation was done. A lot of it was farmed out, which is brand new to Disney, to be farming out, you know, overseas in particular.
Well, yeah, they didn't have an animation department left for them to produce it. They had fired all their animators.
Right, and gotten rid of all the drawing materials.
Right, the people that they were farming it out to were former Disney animators. And they were like, hey, we're making animated movies again. Would you like to, you know, get in on the action? And they already had their own company, so they're shipping it out. Before they made, I was reading up on this, and
well, the first time they had to do it was with Enchanted, because the whole opening sequence.
They had to get used to the process again. Did you guys see the short film How to Set Up Your Home Theater with Goofy?
Oh yeah,
yeah. That was their their prelim work, their workout before they got back in.
Oh, I think we lost him for a second.
Uh-oh.
We'll let him catch back up here.
Disney didn't like what he was saying, and they've cut him off.
They cut him off. He was giving away
their tentacles. Reach everywhere.
Well, to say, you know, to kind of pick up where he was going with that is that John Lasseter sat down and said, okay, we have to get back into hand-drawn, and where do we start? And just like he did with Pixar, he started with a small short, and that's where the Goofy movie came in.
Right.
I'm back.
All right, we've been filling in for you. Den knew the point where you were getting to, so
thanks, Den.
Well, I tried to pick up and keep going. Well, I started off with saying, "Dad, David, he doesn't know what he's talking about," and then I went right really easily from there.
Oh, that's funny. That's where all my friends start too. But yeah, and so
we were talking about Goofy.
Yeah, Goofy, and so they produced this short so that they could get used to the workflow again. What's cool is that actually Goofy was done entirely without paper. It was done entirely on tablets working directly onto the screen. But when they got back to Princess and the Frog, all the animation was roughed out on paper because there's just a tactile element to animation that they were lacking. That there's a big difference between drawing on a screen and drawing on a sheet of paper. There's a big difference to looking at a pencil test that's digital and physical. And they wanted to make sure that the spirit of their animation was good, not just the final visuals.
Well, and you can see it in CGI. It never has quite gotten the soul in it that hand-drawn animation has. Mm-hmm. You know, the famous book that was written about Disney animation, The Illusion of Life, that illusion isn't quite there in CGI. And it's still separated when you're drawing, you know, digitally, as opposed to drawing with a pencil. There's just some life there that gets lost.
Well, one other thing too is in the Disney training of its animators, they went in some of the old days. The studio would bring in live models. They would do rotoscopes to get the motion down right. They would look at the locomotion of people and animals. They filmed doing what they wanted. They kind of what they were attempting to do in the animation. And so the animators did have a good point of reference. They also studied a lot of anatomy so that they would get the feel of the muscles and the joints. They poured a lot of time into developing the animators' drawing style.
Oh, absolutely.
Today, I don't think that's quite as readily done.
I know Pixar does put a lot of effort into the research and they talk about like in some of the making of Finding Nemo that they'd be in a room. Sorry, we lost him again. They'd be in a room and watching some animation, and somebody would say, "A fish doesn't move like that. You can't have that fish move like that." And everyone in the room would be nodding until someone in the room said, "Wait a minute. Fish don't talk either."
Right.
You know, they were so involved.
And their eyes aren't on the front.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you, you said you've been to animation school, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, in your training, how did it go about? How do you draw a character that moves?
Well, you study motion.
Right.
I mean, I did a lot of my study at the shopping mall.
Mm-hmm.
And at the zoo. You would go and watch animals at the zoo. You'd watch people at the mall. And you learn, you know, how they move, what they did. The other thing I did was I had a dual major. I also took anatomical illustration. So I went to medical classes and watched them do autopsies and things. So I got the anatomy right.
Okay, so you saw it both inside and out, so to speak.
Right. Now, let's go ahead and turn that same question on David, who is back with us. He didn't hear the question, so go ahead and repeat it.
The question is, In your training as an animator, how did you learn to draw motion?
How to draw motion?
What was your training like?
First off, down here at SCAD, we start off with a fine arts background. So before I ever even started pushing objects around in motion, I was learning the principles of design, life drawing. Good composition, good visual aesthetics. Just becoming a good artist before I started becoming an animator. Once we started animating, there's first just some simple tests that you do to figure out how the timing goes, like a bouncing ball. That's the standard thing, or a little pendulum, just so that you get used to how frames, how animating frame to frame work. But once we get into stuff like character animation, then we start looking at reference. When I have a character like run around or something, I'll get up and run around. I'll even photograph myself sometimes for this little 15-second short I did where a guy gets slapped in the face. I got slapped in the face, so I knew what it was like before I started animating it.
So you're the method school of acting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got to say, that video is hilarious.
Okay,
I've watched it a number of times, and I laugh every time I watch it.
Okay, so I've got, essentially, looking here, we got two different styles of animation training. You got your style, which is a bit more trade school, and yours is a little bit more art orientated.
Well, I also went to art school. I mean, I studied painting and drawing. But one of the differences was, when I want to show how old I am, we couldn't videotape things and just rewatch it. Mm-hmm. When we were shooting on Super 8, and so you had to go and develop the film, and then you had to splice it together.
So you had, again, some film background. You knew what this thing was going to look like on the screen, and you were trying to, okay, I know, I already have something that's breaking it down frame by frame by frame for me automatically, but I got to know how the light falls on the character. I know how the shadow and what the film effect is going to be.
Well, there was a little of that, but in animation, especially back in the 80s when I was in college, it was more about the motion than even about shadow and things like that. They had another animator that would come in and do a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would do, you know, the special effect animations for that.
Okay.
But it was, and to study, you had to go and study, you know, people moving around. And to study yourself doing it, you just looked in the mirror.
Yeah.
And you did it over and over again.
Our animation department, the main 2D animation room has just a big mirror in front of it, and there's always some kid hopping around or something, trying to figure out just how everything works. It's fun in the facial animation class to see everybody acting out what they're saying, and so you have somebody making the most obscene faces, trying to get the right trying to figure out what muscles are moving on his face for the for like his oohs or his ahs or his is a vowel sound now. Okay.
Nowadays with YouTube, I can imagine, you know, what kinds of things would show up from just animators videotaping each other. You know, the kind of stuff you could put on.
Did you guys see Horton Hears a Who?
No, I have not.
I have seen that. Yeah.
There's a video that it might be on the DVD, but I know that it's floating around the SCAD servers that we all look at for the 3D animation pipeline. And it's just, you know, this guy going through his animation. So first is his reference footage, then it's his blocking one, where it's just kind of rough 3D sculptures at his key poses, and then blocking two, he has more of the in betweens, and then finally he lets the program smooth it out. But it's for the guy who was animating Horton. He actually got down on all fours, and he had his arm up like a trunk, and so he was walking around acting, miming to whatever Jim Carrey was saying. It's hilarious footage. We'll do anything to figure out just how these would move. Going back to Princess and the Frog, the animator for Dr. Facilier...
The actor or the animator?
The animator, the head animator. Let's see now. His name is... Bruce W. Smith, who also directed like Space Jam and Bebe's Kids, he came down and gave a lecture, and he said that for the big transformation, I've Got Friends on the Other Side, for that sequence, every once in a while, like we watched that sequence, and he would say, "Okay, now he's being like now he's doing Michael Jackson, now he's dancing like so and so, now he." Because he pulled up all these different references, and even like his facial movements, they recorded Keith David, the voice actor, in the booth, and he would just get these wild expressions on his face, you know, his eyes bugging out and stuff. And he said, "Well, let's just use that as a basis for our animation." Now that they would riff on it from there, but it was still present in the the production.
And that's something, you know, back from the days of Disney, that, you know, he was filming the voice actors all the time.
Right.
To kind of capture that. The thing that some people have missed the point of is now where they do motion capture.
Mm-hmm.
You get those faces that look kind of dead.
Right.
Because they don't take it the extra step and put life back into it. They just think if you just got the motion and nothing else, that they would live. And even Avatar, there's a little bit of, you know, something to their eyes, or there's something missing that they haven't quite got it.
A good example in the sequence in Princess and the Frog is the sequence with Mama Odie dancing. Because they actually had someone do her dance, and they filmed that, and then they based what they drew on this dance. But at the same time, that character is full of life, full of expression the whole way through.
Yeah, they didn't trace it.
Yeah, it's a very animated performance. But it's they film someone doing it just to have the points of reference down.
Right, so they bouncing across the stage there, they actually bounce across there.
Yeah, and in animation, then you squash and stretch to exaggerate that.
Sure.
Beyond what the person could even do, and that's what sells it.
I mean, the person they had dancing wasn't an 80-year-old woman who lives out on the bayou. They got, you know,
in a boat in a tree.
Yeah, I mean, I could have been the one doing the dance, but as long as I, but the point isn't to trace over it. It's just to figure out, okay, at the, you know, at frame 20, the arm has, is going to track all the way over here, and it's almost like plotting out a dance or something. Like on beat one, your foot goes here. On beat two, your foot turns a half step. On beat three, it steps back, you know, a foot. That's how I've always felt about animation, is that it's,
But in animation, the cool part is that then you can go back and say, you know, like you were watching the instant replay, and fix the stuff that you screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, and make it better than you could have done. I mean, you could bend arms that couldn't bend that way, but first you get the stuff to sell the idea, and then you break the rules.
All right, so getting back to the movie for a minute, one of the things that they very consciously did, and they mentioned in some of the special features, is they took the Disney princess tropes, even the fairy tale tropes. They took them, and they're all there. And you know, they at one point they even point out that Mama Odie's your fairy godmother. You've got Tiana is the princess, of course.
Tiana's the prince. The prince is the princess.
Well, they actually didn't say it that way. They said that the prince was the prince, but they just he's more of a flake.
He was a sidekick.
Yeah, they made him a lot more flaky than their other princes normally are.
Well, that's because, you know, watching the extras, they want to make sure that everyone knows that this is the first African-American princess.
Well,
so,
and
that's,
I think,
why they stressed, I'm sure, that he was that she was the princess.
Well, that and one of the things that I've been very conscious of, I'm, you know, raising a little girl, and a lot of the complaints, there is a lot of complaints about the Disney princesses, especially in the geek community. There's a very strong feelings about the Disney princesses among female geeks. There is a hatred of them, if I will, if I'm going to. But
they're not waiting for a man to come and save them?
No, imagine that. I find that so hard to believe. They just have to go walk into any comic book store and they can have their choice of any man there. But one of the things that I think this movie did right all the way through was that this movie has the character in the role of the princess who is self-sufficient, is strong, works hard. That's what she does. It is to a fault. Someone who is so driven, who is not just going to sit back and let a man take care of her. That's not what she wants. That's not what she's about. Even when it gets to a point where she is falling in love with him, she's still not about just sitting back on her laurels. And even in like the movie Coraline, Coraline still had to be saved. The female character who was the strong female character through the whole movie still in the end was saved by a male, which wasn't the way it was in the book. But in the movie, that's the way it played out. Mm-hmm. In this movie, the final action against Facilier, she does it. It's all her. It's a conflict between Facilier and her. She stands up to him. She's the one that makes the decision. She's the one that throws the sword into the dragon's heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's
true.
And for that respect, that's a big step towards me really adoring this movie. For me, this movie had that same feel that Shrek had the first time I watched it when I was watching Beauty and the Beast that got it right for the first time. That, you know, I mean, that was really the feeling I had when I watched Shrek the first time, that this movie is Beauty and the Beast, but the ending is right, finally. You know, it's not about what you look like, it's about who you are. And I think that's where Shrek hit it right, and I think Princess and the Frog hits it right in the same way of you can be strong, you can be female, you can want love, you can want companionship, but you don't have to sacrifice any of that other stuff. And that's one of the things that I really did like with this one.
Well, the message is essentially if you apply yourself and keep moving towards your dream, you're going to get there. You just can't let it, well, in the final scene where she had, you know, Facilier was practically, you know, handing everything she wanted to, she finally realized it's all a lie anyway. This is nothing I've earned. It was just given.
Right. It's all given, plus at that point, she also realized there was something missing.
Mm-hmm.
And that even with all of that, even with her dream, she did still want companionship in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a really good message for girls. And a lot of times that message doesn't carry through the whole way. You see bits and pieces of it, but it doesn't always make it all the way through.
Yeah, and Coraline is a perfect example of that, where you can imagine the studio came in and went, wait a minute, where's the guy to save the girl?
Yeah, because she's so strong, and she is the one running the show until the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sweeps in and saves her. And it just cheapens everything that happens up to that point.
And I think Disney has gotten sort of the girl power, mm-hmm. you know, recently in Alice in Wonderland. You know, this new version of Alice in Wonderland.
I haven't had a chance to see it yet, so.
You know, she's wearing armor and swinging a sword and, you know, goes to battle. So,
right. They've actually swung so far towards the feminist side that they're retooling their next film, Rapunzel. To be a little more boy friendly, so that the guy in it has something to do, and so they're switching it around now. It's not Rapunzel anymore. It's
Tangled.
Tangled, yeah.
Yeah, because it was Rapunzel Unbraided, and they changed it to Tangled.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So
they've canceled, or at least put on hold the next 2D animation that they were going to put out, the Snow Queen, again, because they're like, well, we don't, you know, and this has kind of got me worried, because you can tell that with Princess and the Frog, they're just doing it because they want to make a good animated movie. But now the suits are coming in and they're saying, how can we make these movies a lot more successful? So their next 2D,
how can we broaden the appeal?
Snow Queen, they're shelving. They're doing Winnie the Pooh instead.
Yeah, like Winnie the Pooh needs to be done one more time.
Yeah, actually, I mean,
they're actively doing Winnie the Pooh on the Disney Channel now. They've got an animated version of it.
Well, they've done, well, part of Winnie the Pooh, again, is so they don't lose the license.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't done a feature with Winnie the Pooh for a while.
Right.
And they went through a whole battle with the Milnes about that, so it was time.
Yeah.
It was funny that the guy who animated Dr. Facilier, he's on the Pooh movie now, and he's animating Piglet now. It's a big difference between Dr. Facilier and Piglet. But he's getting all the women. They're all like, they're fawning over him. Like, what are you working on, Piglet? Oh, I love Piglet.
Ooh.
Piglet gets ladies.
Yeah, wait till they see his version of Piglet. And he's like evil and
edgy.
You know, he worships the devil.
And eats pork.
Piglet's got friends on the other side.
And he eats pork.
He's the pig from Amityville Horror now.
I can't pay my friends on the other side. Oh, did-a-da-deer.
Now, that Winnie the Pooh I would pay to see.
Goth Piglet.
Mm-hmm. Actually, could we talk about the Shadow Man?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
He was incredible
before,
as a villain.
Yeah. Before we do, have you seen... I can't remember the exact name of it. And Chris, who edits the podcast, actually pointed it out to me on Twitter. There is somebody has done like an online book that is basically Pooh versus Alien.
Yeah.
Oh, it is the most twisted, bizarre thing that you have ever seen.
God.
And like, doesn't Piglet become like a full-on alien? I mean, it's
I haven't seen that. That I'm going to have to check out.
It is bizarre.
Pooh versus alien.
This is not something if you have a weak stomach that you want to look at, because it's. I mean, it goes for the full-on chest exploding alien treatment at one point. Well, I mean, you know, you have the perfect scenario because. Pooh always wants to stick his head in the honeypot. So he sticks his head in the egg. He comes out with a face sucker on.
Deep in the heart of the 100-acre wood and lies an evil beyond imagination.
I think that's pretty close to the way it starts.
No one can
scream.
All right, yeah, so Facilier, that was such a great villain. One of the things that I really liked about this also was that... the movie came out like in the end of the year. It was toward the end of the year.
It was around Thanksgiving time, yeah. I think.
Well, about a month and a half before that, we were in New Orleans. So to have just been in New Orleans, to have gone through, you know, we walked through the cemetery. We had been to Jackson Square. We partied on Bourbon Street, walked up and down the river. To then go to the movie and see all of these places. Now, the cool thing about New Orleans is this movie is set in the 20s?
Yeah, 1920s.
It's like April 27th, 1925. I freeze framed on the newspaper announcing Prince Naveen's arrival.
Okay. So it was set in the 20s, but the architecture, the layout, the location, none of that's changed. I mean, the city, it's an old city, and they have very strict rules about, you know, what kind of architecture can go on in certain areas. So what you see, even, you know, what you saw there and what you see now is pretty much the same.
Yeah, and that was really the heyday of New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
Of, you know, the ragtime music and, you know, everything was... at the perfect time to do New Orleans, mm-hmm. to where it was like a fairy tale version of New Orleans that really happened.
And it was, I mean, what's funny is it was so accurate that the ending sequence, you see the Tiana's Palace and they pan out and you see Tiana's Palace and it's the location. I'm looking at it going, they've got really crappy location based on where everything's at, because I know I've been there. I know exactly where that's located. I would have looked across the river at it. It's not in the quarter. It's across the river from the quarter. Why would you want to be there? You want to be on this side of the river. They really did their homework in looking at the city and getting that. I loved that. And Facilier, there's still guys that walk around and act like that and have that charm and flair. Everything is very theatrical there. And there are guys that are just like that. And so it was really neat to see a character like that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was nice about that was the kind of homage they did to Hunchback, where they did, you know, they tried to do the evil, you know, religious figure, and it didn't really play in Hunchback.
Yeah.
And they kind of turned it on its head in this and made it actually work, which I appreciated.
And his M.O. is terrifying. He wants to kill everybody in New Orleans and harvest their souls. I mean,
what's wrong with that?
Well, I, for one,
people
I would
in
rather
Ireland have souls,
and you can tax them for a long time, or I don't know, maybe summon a hurricane. Oh,
dang!
Too soon? No.
Too soon? Too soon?
That's what the heads of Disney want to do: is
suck their souls.
But
they'll swallow your souls.
You know, it's like poachers, pirates who want to steal gold, soul harvesting voodoo priests.
Yeah,
all right.
Well, and the thing is he's a charming guy.
Oh yeah,
he's very smooth, very slick.
Yeah, he has. I love the line when he seals the deal. He's like, "Come on, won't you shake a poor sinner's hand?"
Yeah.
Oh man, that's great.
Well, and that's just. I mean, the way the language like that's the way those guys talk. You know that, especially when you're on Jackson Square and there's a line of carriages, and you walk up. And what's funny is. I had a friend who is a theater major, and she's into performance art, and she studied the city of New Orleans as performance art. And she told me what you need to do is when you go to Jackson Square, when you go on one of these tours, you need to look at the cart, and you need to take a carriage ride, and you need to find one of the old black gentlemen. And take a carriage ride with him. So we're walking down, and we're seeing all these different people, and I see this guy decked out in head to toe in a purple suit, and he's just smooth, and he's got this goatee that has flares of silver in it, and he's just a very dapper-looking man. And I said, and we're half a block away, and I point right to him, and I said, that's our guy. We are gonna take his carriage ride. And he took us on the coolest carriage ride, telling us things about the city. He grew up in the area. Funny thing is, I came back and told her I went on this carriage ride, and she said, "Oh, that was David." I said, "Yes, it was." And she's like, "I know exactly the guy you're talking about. He's fabulous." But I mean, it's just that's the kind of experience you have, and then to relate it to this movie. So where you see these people that this is real. I mean, this is what those people really are. Now, you know, he wasn't into voodoo and all that, but
not that he told
not
you.
That we knew about. My soul is now harvested somewhere in New Orleans. The style and the character and the look, I think they captured it dead on. And it made it even more fun.
Well, and it also harkened back to actually a villain that was scary.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch Snow White, you know, the villain in that is scary as hell.
Yeah.
And since then, they've all been kind of like, I could outrun
comedic
you. Or, you know, it doesn't really feel that scary.
No, well, and no real threat.
And they're, and they're still kind of a boob, you know. You've got, even like in Hercules, you had Hades, and he was still a goofball.
He was like an agent.
Yeah.
You know, a Hollywood agent.
He was a shuckster. I mean, it wasn't as terrifying as this guy.
There was too much comedy in him.
Yeah. I mean, the shadows were creepy. Every time you saw him move, his shadow was doing something different than he was. Mm-hmm. And
well,
that's
reflected.
That's creepy. And for a 7 and a 2-year-old, they pick up on that. I cannot now at this point go boom, 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 boom. The 2-year-old freaks out. She's just like, she loses it.
Well, that's one thing about Dr. Facilier's shadow. It reflects his inner evil. It's all twisted up.
Yeah.
Where he's rather straight and, you know, straight and dapper. It's all wrinkled and twisted and distorted. Mm-hmm. Sort of like it's a reflection of his soul.
And there's another homage to Peter Pan. You know, Peter Pan and his shadow. I mean, all the Disney tradition is in that movie. In a very strong way.
And it even starts the beginning of the movie, the opening, and it was one of those things that it just kinda gave me a smile was the palace. And it was Big Daddy's home, his plantation home. And it was the castle for this movie.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of people forget that Disneyland has New Orleans in it.
Mm-hmm.
That you can go and, you know, sit and have New Orleans style food, and you know, really, it was something that Walt loved, and to have it still, you know, in a movie, I think it really, he would have liked it. I think he would have loved this movie.
Yeah,
yeah. There were a lot of little cameos too that that cropped up, like at the ball, some of the people were dressed up like prior Disney princesses. The dolls at the dolls at the beginning in Lottie's room were all the Disney princesses from mm-hmm. From before, and right when the movie starts out, and like the second before it has the logo, there's a shot down the street. There's a lady shaking out a rug, and the rug is the flying carpet from Aladdin.
Yeah.
Oh, there's also the one classic homage in there where the frogs are bouncing around the table and Big Daddy yells, you know, the classic line from Streetcar Named Desire, which is, of course, set in New Orleans. He yells, Stella!
Yeah. Yeah, and getting to the point of talking back about the movie, it's a formulaic movie. You've got the princess, she meets the prince, there is the conflict with the bad guy, we get thrust into a situation. So, fast forward, we've got these two frogs hopping around the bayou who have befriended a jazz-playing
crocodile.
Which
alligator.
Was, yeah, it was okay, alligator. Yeah, alligator, okay. Which was fantastic. Louis was awesome. But then they meet my absolute favorite character. Ray. And that was Ray.
Oh, yeah.
Raymond. People call me Ray. Yeah, Ray is my favorite, by far my favorite character in this movie.
Yeah, and who has like what, two teeth, but never the same two teeth? It seems like they move around in his mouth.
Yeah. I think I chipped my favorite tooth.
Hey, that captain, can I need some help? Yeah.
Don't make me light my butt.
Who's a lightning bug in love with a star? I mean, you know, that's again an homage to wishing upon a star.
Well, and the girls when they were little wished upon the star. That was, you know, Lottie's fairy tale book said you got to wish on the star.
And it's all built on solid, you know, Disney foundation. And I imagine they sat around a room and had to pitch something that they could sell the idea that it was going to be hand-drawn. So that's probably why they didn't take it too far away from the source, because they were already taking it away by saying, we're going to draw it. As opposed to doing it in CGI and in 3D.
And what's really interesting is, I mean, that the last two big Disney movies are such homage films, between Princess of Frog and Enchanted. I mean, they're just so deep in the Disney culture in both of them.
Well, and Alice in Wonderland is a remake.
Yeah.
So they really are mining their, you know, classic stuff. Not only that, Tim Burton's next one is Maleficent, which is harder to say than it is to be, I guess. But the idea of taking the villain's point of view and turning it on its head.
It's called Wicked.
It is like Wicked, actually.
Well, it's...
But they didn't have to pay for Wicked this way.
What's funny is my niece and nephew had not seen the movie because their age had them off cycle. Mm-hmm. So in reading the books to them, you know, it was me and my brother. So we weren't raised on that stream of Disney movies that's so easy to really do nowadays. So we didn't know the name of that character. So when he's reading the story to them, he pronounces it Maleficent.
And she has a legal problem.
For the longest time, those kids thought that character's name was Maleficent.
Aww.
It'll serve them well when they become lawyers.
Well, I want to ask Bad one thing. One thing in this movie which did surprise me is a Disney character actually died.
Yeah,
and they did treat that as
they
a real
it,
thing.
They and it was, you know, it was, and I think that's what makes Ray my favorite character, is because you saw a whole arc, and you saw him fight. He joined the group. He became part of the team. He died for the cause, and in the end, he got his wish. he became one with his Evangeline, and that was a really cool thing.
Yeah, that death hit me hard.
Yeah,
I was watching it with my I went with my girlfriend, and we were just sitting there, and he just started going, "I can't believe he died. You wouldn't expect this out of a chicken." And then we look at each other, we're both crying, and we're like, "Are we crying over the wacky Firefly comic relief character?"
Yep.
Yes, because he was fantastic. He was. And what's great is that his death drives home the theme where working hard gets you what you want. He never stopped believing that Evangeline was
anything was more than just the most beautiful firefly that he ever did see. As far as he knew, that's all she ever was. I talk to her all the time. She doesn't say much back. She's kind of the quiet type.
Well, that was the fun thing, too. I mean, he's a true believer, even when Tiana tells him, like, it's just a star, and he sits there, don't mind her, she's just speaking out of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he never stopped believing, and in the end, he got his reward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, normally in a Disney movie, you have to be someone's parent to die and actually stay dead the whole movie.
That's true. Yeah. And we did see that with Tiana's father.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very classy way they did it. They had him go off and be a soldier and presumably die during the war. And I thought that was a very... I mean, if there have been lesser deaths from the Disney parents. But that one I thought was a really classy way of doing it. And it wasn't the mother, which is normally the mom is the one that gets it for a princess. Normally for the princess, they lose their female... their mother figure.
Yeah. Which again goes back to the plot of women who can do it without men.
Yes.
You know, even the mother had to do it.
Yeah, she had to do it. She had to do it on her own. She raised her daughter, and she, you know, they stuck with the values, and yeah, more of why this movie just works for me, and it's not just as an animated movie.
Yeah, you know, just thinking about the plot, about working hard to make your dreams come true. I wonder if that's if that was an influence just by getting the film produced. I mean, everybody who worked on it grew up watching 2D Disney animation. They all loved it. That's what gets you into animation. That's what got me into animation. I'm pretty sure that's what got them into animation. That's what gets us into animation, is watching those old films. And then they weren't being made anymore. And so what happened to make this movie is that people who always wanted to see these movies get made again worked very hard to get into a position by which they could affect its eventual creation. John Lasseter is Tiana in a sense, because he didn't just wish that they would happen. He affected its own creation.
He had to leave Disney and then come back and take over Disney to make it happen.
But it happened.
It did,
just like Steve Jobs.
Yeah,
and I mean. Well, I mean, nobody believed in Pixar either. They kicked Lucasfilm kicked Pixar out because they were like, you can't make 3D movies. Nobody wants to see those. And then they went over to Disney, and Disney said, we make 2D movies. Nobody wants to see 3D movies. They kicked them out. Then Pixar made, you know, $1 billion. And they're like, well,
maybe they got something.
Maybe you can. Why don't you come back? And I think there's something there. Yeah.
Maybe just a little bit.
Well, yeah. I have more to say on that, but that'll wait until the Pixar episode.
Yeah, because we are, just for the curious, we are going to do a series of Pixar episodes sometime this summer when we're going to actually get David here. And we're going to tie him down to a chair. And
of course. And then I'll go over to David's house and Skype in. So that what you don't know is that Dave and I are the same person, and we can't be in the same room together.
Otherwise, you'll explode.
True. He's the negative me.
the ambient awesome will overload
He's probably the younger me is what he is.
You would annihilate each other and rip a hole in the space-time continuum.
So that would be kind of cool, actually.
It was pre-recorded by Den a long time ago.
Yeah. Boy, that was really good foresight.
Why, Tony, I thought that you would say that.
Oh.
Why, yes, it was.
It's all editing. Tony just has a bunch of clips and he just slings it all together.
I'm good like that.
Now, how about John McCain as president, huh? Ooh.
Bad for the country.
All right, so anything else?
I think we've pretty much covered everything on this film. I mean, go watch it. You can't be disappointed. Go watch it with your kids. Can't be disappointed either.
Yeah, the one thing that has really been done well lately by a lot of the successful animation studios is that they're making movies that are accessible to multiple age groups and for multiple reasons. I mean, very white 2.5-year-old daughter looked at the screen, you know, because we actually went to the theater. So she was just a month over 2 years old at the time, you know, standing on her booster seat, pointing the screen saying, "That's me." And she was pointing right at Tiana. It was, you know, she's a princess. That's what she's
with the hero.
Yeah. She has identified herself in that role and that's what she wants to do.
Yes, it's true. Tony's daughter was born a poor black child.
Yes.
Now, I mean, that's something we haven't talked about is there was some controversy about, was Tiana black enough? Was she too black? You know, there was a whole bunch of
They actually changed
some of the movie.
Oh, really? Yeah. Originally, her name was Maddie, and they were like, well, that's not...
They showed it to focus groups, and some people were not thrilled.
Yeah, I can imagine. But it would have probably been more accurate for the time period.
Yeah.
Sometimes, actually, has to take a back seat.
Yeah.
What was really cool was Tiana and Lottie's relationship.
You're right.
They've grown up together, and so Lottie, who, you know, she's about as smart as a bag of hammers, but, you know, whenever she just looks at Tiana like a sister because they've grown up for so long. It was really cool, like when she spills all over herself. The first thing Lottie says isn't like, "Why'd you spill everything?" She's like, "I have a perfect dress for you, come on, we're gonna change it, and it's gonna be great."
Yeah, the character of Lottie could have been a foil. They could have very easily made her the snooty, rich little brat. And it would have played. I mean, it would have worked. But it wasn't. That wasn't the character. And it was a character that was very caring and very self-sacrificing. Her sacrifice in the end is arguably as big as Ray's is. You know, she does...
Give up her dream.
Give up her dream. And she, as far as she's concerned, she's just delaying it, you know. And
again, because she didn't earn it.
Well, and her line is, we always read about these dreams in the fairy tale books, and I always dreamed of true love. You found it. I'm not going to stand in the way of that, because that's what she believes in. She believes in true love and fairy tales, and it's happening before her eyes. So she's going to work to see that come true. So it really does play into the whole theme. And Lottie does the effort. She does the work to make the fairy tale come true.
And it does kind of, again, pull back the theme we were talking about, that it gives an interest for the adults.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to see that she's an adult, that fairy tales still mean something to an adult in this, you know, world. And can mean something.
And then they follow it up with the very bizarre, "Well, I didn't know he had a younger brother." "I've waited this long. How old are you again?"
6.5 years old.
Yeah, that was just a little creepy.
That was a little creepy.
I think she's being mostly facetious at that point.
Well, and it also leaves the sequel open, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When she's a cougar.
12 years later.
Princess and the Prog, the tadpole years.
The Prince and the Cougar.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that would be great if Lottie actually transforms into a cougar and goes on a prowl for men.
That would be hilarious. We should start working on that.
That's called Disney Now. We could pitch it.
I would have liked to see her hook up with Lou. There's enough of him to go around.
I just love, by the way. Yes, he just loves rough men.
The single best reference in that movie was the name of the band at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The Firefly Five plus Lou.
Yeah.
Because back in the 1950s, there's a bunch of the animators at Walt Disney Studios got together and made a Dixieland jazz band called the Firehouse Five plus Two. And it's fantastic.
Oh yes.
Wow.
I see the joke now.
Yeah. Yeah, so it, I mean, we've said it over and over again. It was like a Disney fan movie. You know, it's all inside jokes to, you know, they were playing to their choir. Well, and as we were saying, they grew up. These people all grew up on Disney movies and finally got to make their Disney movie.
They get to make one the way they wanted.
And like I said, the only thing that disappointed me about it was that it wasn't a little more subversive. But they're probably working on that now, you know, what will be their next one. Because they were headed that direction with Lilo and Stitch and, you know, and they just never quite got there. And now that whole subversion has gone into CGI with Shrek and, know, the things they're doing now.
Well, and even Enchanted was a subverted version of Disney. Done in such a way that it wasn't.
I mean, when you got cockroaches cleaning, you know, the dirty apartment, you know, I mean, that's just
Honestly, does Disney Princess need subversion? I think that it's kind of nice having one facet of animation. It's always going to be just, you know, the nice story, the family friendly thing.
Well, I'm not saying throw it all out the window.
Identity, I guess.
But they could have broke the mold a little more than they did.
Well, I think they did break the mold in a lot of ways. And I talked about it earlier. They really made the princess self-sufficient. She did what she had to do. The guy was a hindrance to her as much as anything.
That's true. Really, she could have been better off without him in a lot of ways.
She would have through the whole movie. I mean,
right, the character,
her story was a hero's journey in that respect. Mm-hmm. She got stumbled up by a mistake she made at the beginning in involving herself with him.
It's true.
Yeah, the character of Tiana is far more groundbreaking than her race is, just by virtue of her portrayal in the plot.
Well, it is interesting, and how though that they had to tread the line about race and, you know,
it's
making a princess, because they also went through it with Aladdin. You know, with questions of, I don't think they could make Aladdin right now because of, you know, feelings about the Middle East and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad they are broadening that. I just wish they broadened it a little more. But, you know, like I said, there are more movies to make and they can always go there.
At the same time, it's really kind of unfortunate that it had to be as much of a statement as it was, that it's the first African-American princess. That's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that it had to be that much of a statement. And it's not to say that it's a bad thing, but it's just...
We use it as a marketing hammer.
Yeah, because it's not a... It's not...
And it really has nothing about
black,
that.
A black or white film.
No.
I mean, it's
because
just by
because, you
virtue
know,
of who she
had,
where she was.
We've had princesses of various, you know...
Pocahontas?
Yeah, we've Pocahontas, Jasmine, Mulan.
This is like the only color they haven't gotten.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an Eskimo one yet. We don't have an Inuit princess, as far as I know.
Well, that can be
Prince. I mean, they did Brother Bear, which was
That's true.
Eskimo.
They did do Brother Bear. I blanked on that one for a second.
But there wasn't a
princess
per se
in that movie, though.
So I guess the next one will have to be the first alien princess.
Well, that was
Stitch. John Carter on Mars.
There you go.
Well, John Carter on Mars is true.
That takes care of that one.
Though it's not animated. Well, we got four thumbs up.
Yeah, I don't think I've got anything else to add about the movie. Go see it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, now rent it. I guess you can't go see it.
Well, I guess you can rent it. You can go see it on your iTunes.
See, that's on
my... It's not on iTunes?
It's not rentable on iTunes. It is on iTunes for purchase.
Oh, for purchase.
Okay. Same thing on... it is on Netflix, though.
Yeah.
And that is something, actually, I miss about Disney movies, is that they used to periodically come back in the theater. And there's something about seeing a movie like this in the theater that just you lose once it's on video.
It's a shame that they don't... And they might do it in limited... limited runs, but we're never going to see that in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. The weekend before the DVD cycle release of like a Snow White or something, you'll see it. We're not going to see that a whole lot,
except in the dollar theater that has gum stuck to the screen.
True, you
know, that's about it.
True.
I'd love to see Princess and the Frog in 3D.
That would be kind of cool, actually. And how they would pull that off.
The sequence with the fireflies, where they're leading the group to Mama Odie, I think that would be fantastic. Even just take a couple of sequences of the movie and do those couple of sequences for 3D.
I've never understood why they haven't done anything in 2D in 3D, because the process that they use just divides everything up into a series of focal planes.
Right.
And they've been doing that since the multi-plane camera.
Yeah.
And now with After Effects and so on, they're doing it all digitally. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be hard to do.
Yeah.
And it would be... Well, my guess is the next 2D movie will come out in 3D, will be my guess.
Which is just going to mess with all of us trying to talk about it. Right. The 2D, 3D.
How many D's is it again?
We're going to call it 5. We're just going to add them together. 3D.
Now in
5. The honey's just going to come right out at you.
Because I had a discussion the other day on Facebook with a friend about, they were saying, well, I don't know about all these 3D movies. And I said, you sound like my grandfather when he used to tell me, you know, real movies are all still in black and white.
Yep.
I think the only reason every movie isn't in 3D right now is because there aren't enough screens
that can project them. The theaters can't handle them
yet. Yep. When they all can, they all will be. Mm-hmm. For one, they could charge more for it. And, I mean, you'll even see stuff that has no business being in 3D in 3D just because they can.
Yeah. When we talk to those guys from N3, one of the things that'll be interesting is once you have a generation of filmmakers who are raised on good 3D and shooting a movie for 3D instead of just
tacking it on
or using it as a special effect. I think that's one of the things that Avatar really succeeded in, was it used the 3D for ambiance. It used it to draw you into the world. Mm-hmm. And with just a few exceptions, it really didn't use it for the, oh my goodness, there's a shock effect coming out at me. I've got to duck now. You know, they didn't really do a whole lot of that.
Yeah, it wasn't 3D. Well, I saw Up in 3D, mm-hmm. and it was the same thing. It wasn't like the 1950s,
right.
You know, where things were coming at you and the whole thing. It was all aimed at enhancing the story.
Right.
And people who do that are going to do well. And a perfect example of it, too, is Clash of the Titans, which was filmed to be 2D, and then they did a lousy conversion to 3D.
Dimensionalized it.
And just, you know, to grab some bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And people know. I mean, you can tell. Plus, the internet's out. You know, the second crappy 3D hits the screen, somebody's going to be on the internet going, go see it in 2D.
Yeah, don't waste your money.
So that's how I ended up seeing Clash of the Titans in 2D.
That's when Darren reviewed it, he reviewed it and said, "I spent the money for 3D. I wish I would have just went to see it in 2D," because for him it was actually a disappointment when it would have been probably perfectly fine in 2D. He probably would have enjoyed it a lot more had he not paid more and had an expectation built up of what it could be in 3D. But it was shot in 2D, so it really didn't matter.
Well, and there are technical things about how many frames it takes you to be able to tell that it's three-dimensional.
Transformers 3, they were wanting to do it in 3D, and Michael Bay said, no, with all the shaky cam and quick cuts that I do, it wouldn't actually work. You couldn't see it.
He'd be like, I can't work this way. It would take all of Michael Bay's tricks away.
Yeah, he couldn't use...
As much as they'd want Megan Fox in 3D, they just can't do it for that one.
I think that my own feelings are, I think 3D TV is going to be a huge flop.
As long as you have to wear glasses.
If you have to wear glasses, yeah, it's not going
to
work.
They're going to have to get it.
And there's really, and I think the market for 3D television is for sporting events. If you can film sporting events the right way using 3D television, I think you could really do some really interesting stuff with it. I don't know that many people that spend all day just, you know, I know some people that do, that spend their Sunday sitting around watching football. But
you've just described most of my relatives, yeah.
And for those people, if they've got the disposable income to afford that kind of television, because it's going to be ridiculously expensive, there's probably going to be a market for it, as long as the networks are willing to do the cost of filming in 3D or shooting, really just shooting the sporting event.
Football in 3D will be a success when they figure out how to get the camera inside the ball.
Yeah.
Jeez.
There's somebody at Fox working on that right now.
Now, football cam. Zoom in.
Yeah, every helmet.
So Jeff is Jeff
the,
proves
the
shot
point. Of the crowd, and there's the fat guy with like his chest painted all blue, and you can like see his man boobs just projecting out at you.
Now I have to sit back in my seat because the belly might get me.
Now you've got the idea. That's what we're after.
I think you just killed 3D TV for me now.
But just imagine the commercials during the Super Bowl.
And I think that would be some of the drivers of where you're going to see the next wave of 3D filmmakers is probably going to be after the people who make the 3D commercials for 3D television.
Oh, absolutely.
Because these are the people that are going to have to learn how to do it in very small bites.
And then we'll have the 3D ad channel, all 3D, all the time.
Yeah.
It's probably all coming. Unfortunately, even high def hasn't caught on as quick as they hoped it would.
Well, the one reason is there's just not enough high def programming out there yet.
There's
It's coming, there's but it's
lot.
Getting here. It's getting here a piece at a time. You got to get the cable companies, the satellite companies to carry
the
stuff.
Part of it is the economy tanked about the same time, too.
Right.
And when you have to choose between feeding your kids and getting a Blu-ray player, it's not a tough choice.
Yeah, that Blu-ray player is really necessary.
I love mine.
Okay. It makes
I'm the guy who owns one. I'm that guy. As opposed to Skittles from last week.
And I will say that Tony's kids still look like they've been fed, so it's okay. Everything's all right.
They do.
No one panic. Well, do we have anything else about Princess and the Frog?
Nope.
No, I think
we've
that's it.
Covered it all.
I thought the episode was done.
I think we can now call it done. So we're done. Good night.
Good night.
Next week, as long as everything goes as planned, we will be talking about Hero tomorrow. Good luck finding it.
That was some homework here. Thank you all for coming to check.